Support for WKAR is provided by Astera Credit Union, a proud supporter of Current State's Neighbors in Action segment. Newest location is now open on West Saginaw Highway on Lansing's west side. Information at asteracu.com. And by City Pulse. Wednesday's issue explores whether the City of Lansing should solve its fiscal problems by selling the Board of Water and Light. On newsstands and online at lansingcitypulse.com.
How sweet it was! Who among us was expecting a third-degree blowout at the Breslin Center last night? Congratulations, Spartans, from Current State here at WKAR. 75-52. Everybody played a role, to be sure. So congratulations. Up next, it's Nebraska in Lincoln on Saturday night, an 8 p.m. tip, and the women host Indiana tonight at the Breslin Center. Good morning. I'm Mark Bayshore. Andy Belaskovitz is managing editor of the Lansing City Pulse. He has stories appearing in today's edition of the paper and online at lansingcitypulse.com. And we want to talk with him about a couple of things he's got in today's paper. We're talking Lansing City Council and the Board of Water and Light. Andy, welcome to Current State.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
First, the City Council. What appears to be a pretty emotional situation has developed involving Council member Kathy Dunbar, but other battle lines have also started to appear. This apparently involves the city-issued laptop computer that Dunbar uses and that all city council members have. How did this get started?
Well, this, at least for me, this whole story started about 2 weeks ago when I, on an unrelated story, I had asked the city council president, Carol Wood, about committee assignments, which is the role of the council president every year to assign members to committees. And I noticed that Kathy, who's served just about two full terms on council, wasn't chairing any committees, which she had done in the past few years. She wasn't serving on any boards and commissions as she had the past few years. And so I asked Carol basically what the deal was with that, and her response a couple weeks ago was, it's a private matter being discussed in closed session. So that kind of piqued my interest, I guess you could say. So for me, that's when I started poking around and asking questions about why the council was meeting in closed session. It turns out they had a meeting or two in early January about computer usage policy. And after asking the city attorney, you know, what that meant, he said it's about a confidential legal opinion, and he couldn't comment any further about that. So that's kind of where we were about a week ago. Meanwhile, the personnel committee of the council has been meeting week in and week out to basically update its computer usage policy. However, there's been, according to some meeting minutes, it looks as if they've been talking specifically about Kathy Dunbar's computer. And the most recent meeting yesterday, which today's story is about, is how the chair of that committee is looking to go back and revise those. She's saying these meetings are not specifically about Kathy. They are about this broader computer usage policy. So also, as this is happening about a week ago, Kathy issued a public statement, saying a pretty lengthy public statement, saying, giving the whole background about how this computer was damaged, had to do with an argument of her former marriage. So we're getting into some things that are really personal in nature. And the whole thing is just kind of snowballed into this, as Kathy paints it, sort of an election year politics, where she thinks this Carol Wood and Brian Jeffries faction of council is teeing her up and trying to set her up for this what appears to be a scandal at this point, but we don't really know what was being talked about in closed session at this
point. So there's all kinds of levels to this to this story, and I want to make sure our listeners understand and the host understands as well. What's at issue is whether a city employee, another city employee, erased information from Kathy Dunbar's city-owned laptop, and is it clear that that happened, or is it unclear that that happened?
Well, what the meeting minutes have shown for the past few weeks is it looks like this committee speculated that this city employee somehow colluded with Kathy in erasing some things that were on there inappropriately. Now, yesterday in committee, the committee chair, Aileen Robinson, said, no, we're not saying that's what happened. We're saying if that were to happen, we need a procedure in place to deal with it. Meanwhile, I think in the story today, you'll read about this exchange between Aileen and the mayor's chief of staff, Randy Hannon, who showed up at committee yesterday and basically lambasted this committee for sort of implicating this department head and somehow colluding with Dunbar.
And another key factor in this story is whether council meetings involving computer usage should have been closed. There have been a couple of these, right?
That's right. That's right. And at least one council member, Jessica Yorko, has come out publicly saying she doesn't think the council should have been meeting in closed session. Everyone else on the council I've talked to has said we're going on the advice of former city attorney Brig Smith and the interim city attorney's opinion now, and are basically not commenting why they're meeting in closed session specifically.
But it's unclear that this IT employee for the city of Lansing, it is still not clearly resolved whether or not he did help erase information from Kathy Dunbar's laptop?
Well, what we know, we obtained this memo between Carol Wood and this IT director, his name's Eric Tumbarella, that Carol had asked him in an email when this laptop was brought in, this damaged laptop was brought in, what was done to it, and was there any conversation between you and Kathy? And based on Eric's response, it was sort of a business as usual. This was just a broken laptop, a broken screen of a laptop. It was nothing more than replacing it with another sort of, shell of a computer, you might say, replacing the hard drive. He said he doesn't recall any specific conversations with Kathy about this. So as far as he's concerned, it was just sort of business as usual, fixing a broken laptop.
So I guess the key question here is, has a legitimate discussion about computer policy on the council been twisted and subverted into something more scandalous than it needs to be?
I think that's fair to say, and it's almost hard to say which came first, this scandal about what's on Kathy's computer, or we need to revisit this computer usage policy. Now, what was, as Aileen Robinson adamantly said to me yesterday in committee, we're not meeting about Kathy, we're meeting about this computer policy that was first drafted in 2003, and now it needs to be revisited because there's some new council staffers who need to be familiar with this. And when an instance like this comes up, a broken computer, how are we going to deal with it? And if there needs to be some sort of sanctions or consequences in place, how will that unfold?
It is interesting, though, that it does seem to break down into a pitting the mayor's supporters on the council against a number of his detractors on the council. So the classic lines have reappeared in the middle of this dispute.
Exactly. And I was thinking about this last night. This might be the most fractured the council's been along those lines since the marketplace debate over some project labor agreements, I think, in the fall of 2010, from what I can remember, at least.
You FOIA'd some documents as specifically as possible. What do you want to learn?
We want to know why the council is meeting in closed session. We want to know what this legal opinion is. Are we entitled to know what it is? And was there any more exchange that between council members or the city attorney's office regarding Kathy? We really want to know why there's so much interest in her hard drive.
I wonder about the longer-term impact of this, too. Do you think the council will eventually agree to revise its protocol involving laptops and repairs and IT?
Certainly. I think that'll happen in personnel committee. I think it sort of remains to be seen how this aspect about Kathy Dunbar plays out.
We're talking with Andy Belaskovitz of the Lansing City Pulse about Lansing City Council and other city news. Your cover story today, coming out a little in just a few hours, involves a suggestion made recently, I think this was for the financial health team's consideration, to sell the city-owned Board of Water and Light. Tell us more about that.
Well, this wildly unpopular idea to privatize the Board of Water and Light. This financial health team is responsible for looking at short-term and long-term solutions to the city's budget deficit. And this actually isn't the first time the idea of privatizing BWL has come up. I guess when the head of the financial health team, David Hollister, was mayor, he was approached by a company about doing so. And he said there was just no incentive or rationale to do so at the time. We weren't in such dire financial straits at the time. Times are different now, though, he said. There's a story in the State Journal, I think, is when it first surfaced the day before the mayor's State of the City speech that suggested this idea, that this could be a long-term recommendation coming out of the team. The next day at his speech, Mayor Bonero rejected the idea wholeheartedly, said BWL is not for sale, this is not a good idea. And just a wave of other elected officials, public officials have come out saying this is a terrible idea.
There's consensus that would be a bad idea, though. I think Carol Wood even agrees that.
There is consensus, but we sort of approached it as, well, the mayor's always said everything is on the table for this budget situation, so why can't we at least talk about it, right? So, you know, we've come across at least one city employee who's also a steward of local Teamsters union who's said, let's consider it. Mayor Hollister has, to me, sort of outlined the pros and cons of doing so. He said there's certainly trade-offs. There's this billion-dollar number that gets thrown around out there about essentially what the BWL is worth. Now, BWL has over $1 billion in assets and growing. It also has about $500,000 in long-term debt. So at this point, we really can't say, because there hasn't been a detailed analysis about what the city could get out of a deal like this, to say, well, the city would get $1 billion for this if they were to privatize BWL. We just can't say that at this point because we don't know. However, the number gets thrown around, whether it's $1 billion, whether it's hundreds of millions of dollars. The few proponents say that's a lot of money that could go into the city and deal with some infrastructure issues.
Well, I think there's a consensus. It appears there's a consensus that selling the BWL would result in higher rates for Lansing Electric customers, though, correct?
Correct. Several sources said that, and it's, you know, they say it's based on largely history of private utilities doing what they can to maximize profits for shareholders. Now, the rates would still be subject to regulation, albeit by the Michigan Public Service Commission. So, also opponents also say, well, the BWL has a board of commissioners here that meets in Lansing and deals with business in front of city council. BWL customers are much closer to essentially their regulators. If it were to be privatized, you know, interaction with the PSC would happen few and far between, essentially. So they would have this, they would lose this sort of hometown, I guess, sense or sense of control over their utility.
Hometown power, hometown pride.
That's right.
That's
right.
That would be, that might be, could be a casualty there.
That's right.
Andy Belaskovitz has a couple of stories in the new Lansing City Pulse. It is on the newsstands later today, and you can also read them online at LansingCityPulse.com. This has been really good. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Mark.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Each Wednesday on our Neighbors in Action segment, we feature a person or an organization that's working to make our community a better place. This is a listener-generated segment, meaning that each week, the person or organization we highlight will be nominated by you. Yes, you. For this week's Neighbors in Action, we look at Epiphany Now, which organizes at least two events a year where everyone and anyone is invited to gather together and pay kindness forward. It started in 2009, and the events have drawn so much interest that last year Epiphany Now was featured on the CBS Evening News. And with me in the studio to tell us how Epiphany Now works is the founder, Bob Hoffman, who is also the public relations director for the Wharton Center, and Ann Kraft, owner of UZoom Media, who's participated in every one of the Epiphany Now events. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Great to have you in here. You've gotten an awful lot of ink on Epiphany Now. You must be happy. Ink and electronic media on what you're doing.
I'm happy because people get it. You know, in this community in 2009, when everyone said that Michigan is dying and mid-Michigan is suffering, people came together and understood what it means to give something back.
You struck a chord. I mean, you really did strike a chord. That's from my perspective, you have.
Absolutely. You know, it's the community that has made this grow. It's the people out there that understand how it works and why it's special. And it's just taken off, and since it's gone all over the place, Chicago, everywhere.
Explain the idea behind paying it forward.
Well, we started out by saying it's paying it forward, but we've changed it to pass it forward because there's no money involved. Money doesn't have to be involved. It's about just doing something kind for somebody else, just validating another person. So we get a large group of people together. We give them 100 different ideas of things that they could do to make a difference in somebody else's life. Now, that may be buying a cup of coffee for somebody. That may just be going out and mowing somebody else's lawn. But the key is people do this all the time. People pass it forward all the time. What we do is we gather you back together and we have you go up and share your story about what you did. So when you have an audience of 300 people and you're on stage and you say, this is what I did and this is how it feels, and everyone gives you a round of applause, it's an amazing feeling. You want to go out and do it again, am I?
It's the collective energy that really gets everyone going, because when you do something nice for someone else, you feel great about it. But when you do something nice for someone else and you have 300 other people that have done something really cool, and that collective energy, it's like 1 + 1 = 3. It's amazing.
And what do you think your most memorable activity has been so far?
I've done a couple of things that were really cool. One of them was we got just put some little fruit baskets together, and we handed them to people who were shopping at Goodwill. And as they came out, we handed them a fruit basket and just said, we wanted to make your day brighter. Here's some fresh fruit for you. And we figured, well, people who are shopping at Goodwill can probably use a little extra hand up, so here you go. And it's kind of funny because some people don't know how to take it.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, no, thank you. I'm like, really? The orange is not poison. But another time we took little $5 gas cards and happy smiley face cards and just wrote, we want to make your day great, and put them on the cars in the parking lot that looked like they needed repair.
It's amazing, isn't it, how distrustful people can be and how suspicious you end up looking sometimes. No good deed goes unpunished. You know, it's like, why are you doing this for me again?
Why not?
Well, they ask, why are you doing this? And they're a little hesitant at first. But then once they get the idea, and then you invite them because you give them a little card and you say, pass this card on, do something nice for somebody else. They get the card and then they get it. And you can see their eyes light up. And we have people that come back to the event that didn't know anything about it, come back and share their story and say, this was amazing. This totally made my day. And then I went out and made somebody else's day, and it feels really good.
They're getting religion, I guess.
Epiphany. Yes and no.
Epiphany is a religious term.
It is, and you know what? It is, and the reason we spell it E-P-I-F is pass it forward, A-N-Y, N-O-W, because you can have an epiphany right now. And the epiphany is that if you look somebody else in the eye and just validate them for a moment, you know, it makes you feel good and it makes them feel good. We say that we're not religious, we're not affiliated with any type of religion, or we're not political. We're just people helping people.
Yeah. What stands out in your memory, Bob?
I think that one of the things that stands out is two things. One of the things was that people went to a gas station. They pooled their money together. In fact, it was the Weberville cheerleaders got together, took $2 each, pulled it in together, had about $30, decided to go to the gas station and buy somebody gas. The first car that came through was a convertible Mercedes. And they were like, oh, we're not going to do that. Well, they ended up trying to buy the guy gas. He was like, I don't know. You know, very standoffish. They gave him a card anyways and said, well, maybe you could just do something nice. He ended up buying gas for everyone else that was in the gas station because they gave him permission to do something nice. And in turn, he left in a different state than when he arrived. And then the other one was people went to the mission and bought stamps, pins, and pads of paper and said, write your loved ones. And, you know, gave them permission to write their loved ones or people that they've made an influence in their life, because we all have people that have influenced our lives for the positive. And that was an incredible experience when people were saying that the reaction of the people that they were giving it to were like, I never would have thought about this. Thank you.
Well, given the response that people have had, are you picking up a lot of disciples? Are you picking up a lot of new members?
Every single time.
It's a little crazy. We get requests from all over the country for people who want to start a chapter or do an event or, you know, just do something. I'm on the advisory board also, and we've talked about putting together school programs and putting together communications packages so that we can duplicate this all over. People love the idea. They want to do it. They catch on fire, and they just want to keep going with it.
When you come, we have ideas for you. And as I said, it doesn't have
100?
To cost a thing. We have 100, but, you know, every time we record them, because it's like every time you hear something new, you're like, oh, my gosh, what a great idea. I would have never thought. People will get together and they'll write soldiers a thank you. They'll write their teachers a thank you.
Even if it's pumping gas when it's cold outside and washing windows at the self-serve gas station, people really appreciate something like that.
It's just doing the extra thing.
Yeah. What thought did you have, Bob Hoffman, that led to this? What, do you remember the germ of the idea that you had?
Yeah,
the germ
I was in
of the thought?
I was in traffic. Somebody cut me off in traffic, and my immediate reaction was an angry one. And I thought they weren't even paying attention to me. And then I realized that I wasn't paying attention to anything else around me or anyone else around me. And from there, it just kind of bloomed. When I was 8 years old, my dad, my stepdad, came home one time and he says, I was in Pennsylvania and I was on a bridge overlooking the beautiful scenery. And a guy pulled over and gave him $100 and said, it's not worth it. And my dad said, oh, no, that's not what I want to do. And and he's like, well, here's $100. Just pass it on. And that was when I was like 8 years old. And then, you know, fast forward years later, my dad actually passed it on. My stepdad actually passed it on to a police chief in our town that lost his job and gave him the $100. So I think maybe that was the impetus.
Yeah.
And then years later was when it all came together.
When's your next event and what are you doing?
This Sunday, yes. February 17th, from 2 to 6, show up at 2 o'clock at the MSU FCU headquarters in East Lansing on West Road, and show up at 2 o'clock. We give you ideas, we send you out, and then we invite you to come back around 4:30 and start sharing your story.
I feel the love.
It's awesome.
And if you could register online, that would help us. We're going to have some refreshments on hand.
Okay.
So the website's a little bit different. It is epifanynow.org.
Bob Hoffman's the founder of Epiphany Now. Ann Kraft is an enthusiastic participant. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
And if you'd like to nominate someone or an organization to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment each Wednesday, please send an email to currentstate.com. at WKAR.org, put Neighbors in Action in the subject line, and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. You can even nominate yourself if you like. In fact, today's segment on Epiphany Now was suggested by Bob Hoffman.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. If you have any questions or comments about Current State, you can always email us at currentstate@wkar.org. Or if you'd like to join in on the conversation, follow us on Twitter at @KARCurrentState.
Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us. I don't know a soul who is not at least mildly disturbed when they drive by a Lake Michigan or Lake Huron and they notice that the water levels are dramatically lower than they used to be. That is just upsetting visually, and it just leads to all kinds of questions, and we're going to try to answer some of those questions this morning. Some of our Great Lakes are dropping to record low water levels. Receding waters not only causing environmental challenges for the Great Lakes Basin, but it's also impacting the state's economy. Now, to offset the water levels, state lawmakers are trying to fund projects to dredge harbors and marinas throughout the Great Lakes region. And to talk about dredging and the future of the Great Lakes water levels, we welcome Patrick Dorn, Director of Conservation for the Michigan Chapter of the Nature Conservancy, and John Allen is Director of the Michigan Office of the Great Lakes. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Well, it's Lake Michigan and Lake Huron, I understand, whose levels have dropped the most dramatically. Am I right about that?
Yeah, they're hydrologically connected, so they drop together.
Okay, and is there any informed consensus as to why?
You know, I think the big point, first, is just say lake level fluctuations are a naturally occurring event. Our lakes have always fluctuated for hundreds of years, but I think in the past couple of years, we've hit a couple of events that I don't want to give the perfect storm language, right? We've had some higher air temperatures, higher water temperatures, which lead to less ice cover. And we've also had less precipitation, both precipitation in terms of rain and snow. And so combined, those are less inputs into those lakes and more evaporation from those lakes, which have led to lower lake levels.
So we got climactic reasons. Do we have others?
Well, I think Pat's right that on cycle, we are at the bottom end of what has been historically a very long-term natural set of cycles. That doesn't help our boaters, and that doesn't help communities that need to get on the water. We're at the bottom edge of what has been a long-term pattern of highs and lows. Where we've been, though, over the last 10 to 12 years, we've seen some evidence from National Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, that water levels have been low for longer periods of time than we've seen in the past and can continue to stay low. So we need to plan and make sure that we're adapting and planning for the potential for longer-term low water levels.
Well, let's address some of the environmental concerns. There are environmental and economic impacts here. Some of the environmental concerns, what are they?
Well, again, first, we have natural lake level fluctuations, and when we hit these low levels, actually in the last 30 years, we've had both record high levels and record low levels in that 30-year time frame. But when we hit those low levels, we start to see impacts on our coastal wetlands. So, for example, there might be less habitat for fish to spawn. Fish might not have access to some of the streams in which they've spawned because the lower levels expose culverts that they can't jump over.
Okay.
So we see impacts like that. We see less impacts for migratory birds. We're going to enter our April and May major migration. This is a migration corridor that's unrivaled in the world. There might be less habitat, but on the plus side, there might be more soils or more flats exposed for shorebirds to feed. So we have some both pros and cons.
One of the things we're concerned also with low water levels in Saginaw Bay and some other areas, does that also provide additional opportunities for the expansion of invasive species like the giant grass or the giant reed Phragmites?
Yeah.
Does this expand or potentially exacerbate their proliferation? It's something that we need to keep a strong eye on.
But then again, the one thing we do look for is these systems, our coastal systems, have evolved or adapted to fluctuating lake levels, and those actually fluctuating lake levels give rise to a productivity for those species. So again, we're used to that we might see some near-term impacts from low lake levels, such as the increased habitat for invasive species. But we also might need to have those fluctuations over the long term.
I'm really curious. How recently were Great Lakes water levels at record highs? You said within the past 30 years?
1986, there was more water than we knew what to do with at that time, essentially.
Oh,
I mean, houses were eroding in, and there was substantial beach erosion at that point. So
lost
we've seen
property,
a pretty big fluctuation even over that period of time.
Well, it seems like a long time
it
ago.
It does, and I think this kind of gets to people's frame of reference when they look at the lakes now.
Right.
They might not remember 30 years ago. When they think about 30 years ago now, it might mean the drastic change now is a huge change that they've seen in their lifetime.
Continue, John.
I was going to say, the critical piece that the governor has identified for this cycle, given the low levels and given the potential for persistence of low levels, is to make sure that we have a healthy, viable boating season. I think it's important that we make sure that our coastal communities that really rely heavily on the marina and the boating industry, that we have a short-term emergency plan to make sure that we're dredging in enough places that we can maintain the Harbor of Refuge system for Michigan. That's health and safety of people on the water, that we can get people onto the water, that they can enjoy really the gems of Michigan, and that is our Great Lakes. So we do have a plan in place. The governor has articulated about $21 million extra
right.
in that range to make sure that we can provide assistance to our communities to make sure that Michigan's open for business this year.
What are some of the, you're touching on an economic impact
Absolutely.
Here. Let's go a little further into
sure.
that. What are some of the other economic impacts?
I had the privilege of working with the International Joint Commission on a study that was just completed last year, and we kind of broke the impacts of lake level changes down into sectors. So you see a transportation sector. So we ship iron ore and coal and grains around the Great Lakes to the tune of 20 million tons a year. One major impact is that they might not be able to access some of these ports, and they might have to carry lighter loads, which means they are shipping less or in a greater number of trips. There's a fuel impact, and so they might have that impact. You see impacts on recreations. Again, if our right. boaters come and they can't get access to their slip, or they have slips up the river a little bit and they have a little more shoreline than they did a few years ago, they might be less likely to visit some of these places.
And we're also making sure that ferries, Beaver Island, Sugar Island, and so the car ferry side of the system is also, you know, recognized as a need as water levels fluctuate, because that's also where land and water meet, right? That's where boats and
if the governor's dredging plan got the go-ahead here and we moved on this $21 million dredging project,
right.
to what extent would that address the current problem?
That really does not address the current problem of lake levels. That allows an adaptation to keep those ports or marinas in business, but it does nothing to really address the fact that these lake levels are at a low level now. So it's part of an adaptation at this particular point in time, but it's not a long-term change in how the lakes are going to fluctuate.
John.
It recognizes the short-term need, and it does provide necessary funding to make sure our harbor communities can get boats on the water and they can have their summer season. We do need longer-term strategies, and the governor's also articulated to make sure that we look at longer-term durable funding. The transportation package, for instance, that the governor has talked about would add additional monies that would flow then into the waterways fund, or the Waterways Commission would be able to then look at long-term strategies for dredging, for harbor maintenance, for infrastructure maintenance within our coastal communities. So that's another aspect of what the long-term plan is. And Pat's right, we also need at some point a pivot point around dealing with dredging only as dredging, and it's ultimately a strategy for what is the long-term health of coastal harbor communities. What is sediment doing in those systems? Where is it coming from? Where is it going? And how are we managing those as healthy, functioning systems?
First things first here, though, have you taken the political temperature in terms of the $21 million dredging? I mean, do you expect that to happen?
I have heard nothing from the legislatures that suggest that they don't also recognize the crisis and the epic need that we have. If anything, I think the legislature recognizes, and rightly so, that there may be additional needs beyond the $21 million. Finding those strategies to make sure that we're attending to those is an ongoing series of conversations. But I think the legislature is very supportive. I was at a press conference yesterday that they on the Senate side that said they recognize this important need, this pressing need, and they're also looking to move Michigan forward, and we're looking to work with them together.
It's so visually impactful, though. I think right. anybody who goes right. up north ends up noticing it, and that that really registers with people. So we want to thank both of you for joining us here today. John Allen is director of the Michigan Office of the Great Lakes. Patrick Dorn is director of conservation for the Michigan chapter of the Nature Conservancy. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Current state on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. The high-flying Spartans aren't the only ones taking to the winter skies recently. WKAR's Peter Wharf has more.
Some might say that walking through the woods on a cold, snow-covered February night in Michigan is for the birds. And it was last Saturday night during the Harris Nature Center's Owl Prowl. Actually, dozens of families enjoyed a crystal-clear, starlit Saturday night, starting with a crackling bonfire and Harris Nature Center park naturalist Katie Adams.
Okay, as soon as that train is done making noise, we'll get started. If you have not checked in with Allie yet, she's over here at the picnic table happily collecting your money.
The Owl Prowl is one of a number of winter nighttime activities at the Nature Center. On select evenings, the Harris offers night hikes, cross-country skiing, and other events, such as the Howl at the Moon guided night walk, where you can bring your dog along. Before we head on to the trails, naturalist Katie Adams prepped us on Michigan's winged nighttime predators.
So we're going to learn about owls tonight. I'm assuming you're all here because you love owls and because you're really, really, really hoping to see or hear owls, right? And please know that I can't make any promises of what a wild animal is going to do, okay? But I can tell you that we do have...
Michigan owls include the barn owl and the barred owl, that's B-A-R-R-E-D. Also the eastern screech owl and the great horned owl.
How many of you have seen, like, pictures of the great horned owl? Are those horns?
No.
Are they ears? What are they?
Feathers.
They are feather tufts. What are they for? They're not for hearing. Those are basically mostly for camouflage. So if you picture an owl sitting in a tree, they already have some of the best camouflage in the world. And then they have these things that look like branches on the tree sticking off of their head. All right, let's hear what he sounds like. He doesn't say much, does he?
The Harris Nature Center was designed to show off the Red Cedar River habitat through exhibits, many school and public programs, and exploration of the natural area. The center's main building is surrounded by forests, meadows, over 5 miles of nature trails, and a 3/4 mile paved loop trail, all on the banks of the Red Cedar River.
The northern hawk owl. Has anybody ever heard of a hawk owl? Have you heard of a hawk?
I'll leave it here in case I do.
And you've heard of an owl?
Yeah.
Anybody want to guess why they would call this a hawk owl? Because you can only be one or the other, so I don't know why you can be called both. What do you think? They're alike in what way?
Because they have the body of a hawk and the head of an owl.
I love it. That's a really great guess. You're very close. They do look a lot like a hawk. And so the hawk owl is actually very comfortable being out during the daytime. And they love to sit out in the open like hawks do. But they have a facial disc, which clearly makes them an owl. Here's what they sound like.
Kind of like a gobble.
Finally, we headed to the woods in hopes of hearing an owl call, or maybe even to see a huge pair of wings swoop through the trees. But dozens of families, many with smaller children, make a fair amount of racket, crunching and squishing through the snow-packed trails. Katie Adams put her digital owl caller to work in hopes of a response. But nothing. Though the sharp-eyed guide said she saw something.
I'm the only one that saw it, so it's like my word against yours, right?
There's a very large bird that flew through there pretty silently.
The next Harris Nature Center Howl at the Moon event takes place Saturday night, February 23rd. For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
This is the place where you would see the barred owls here at this nature center. They're nesting out here in the wetlands somewhere.
Welcome back to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The organization Business Leaders for Michigan calls itself the state's Business Roundtable. It's composed of the top executives of Michigan's largest job providers and universities. The group includes MSU President Luana Simon, U of M's Mary Sue Coleman, and others. Business Leaders for Michigan claims its members power one quarter of the state's economy and educate nearly half of the state's university students. And Doug Rothwell is Business Leaders for Michigan's president and CEO, and he joins us today on Current State. Great to see you.
Good morning, Mark.
Who are among your better known members? I would assume we've got Dow and Meyer and General Motors.
And all of those and more. So we have the likes of Bill Ford from Ford Motor Company and Jim Hackett from Steelcase and Jeff Fettig from Whirlpool. And so all the name brand companies you're used to in Michigan are members of our board.
But I see two men in a truck based in Lansing, Michigan, is also a member of Business Leaders for Michigan.
Well, you know, it's important, I think, that we have some of the up-and-coming companies as well in Michigan that are going to be the next large companies. And Two Men in a Truck's a great example of that. Briggs Sorber's a terrific board member.
You're unveiling something today at the Capitol that hopefully will help a lot of Michigan families and non-Michigan families as well, I gather. This involves which college to send your kids to. Tell us more about that.
Exactly. So if you go to the Business Leaders for Michigan website, which is businessleadersformichigan.com, later today, you'll be able to go on there and find out how your university that you would like either your child to go to or already goes to performs against their peers nationally. So, for example, if your student is thinking about going to Michigan State University, you can see how Michigan State does in terms of graduating students, its retention of students, how much it costs, how efficient Michigan State is compared to their national peers. So that would include the University of Michigan and Wayne State here in Michigan, but it would also include the likes of Indiana University and others out of state as well.
So it's not just for Michigan folks. I mean, people from outside the state could gain something from this as well.
You absolutely could. And I think we were doing it because we wanted to have more transparency. There's a lot of good data out there. It just was never packaged very well to make it accessible for parents and policymakers to get access to.
BusinessLeadersForMichigan.com is the web. Well, is that the name of the website? They can link to it from your main site.
Just go right to our main site, and then there's a place on there you'll very clearly see where you can get to the data.
And that's brand new. I know higher ed is one of your organization's three top priorities for 2013. The governor has proposed a 2% bump in state funding. Are your members more pleased, or are they more frustrated that it couldn't have been more?
Well, we're pleased in the fact that it's been the second year in a row now of more funding. I mean, we went through a decade of budget cuts that really cut higher education more than any other place of the state government's budget, 50% cut over the last 10 years. Second year in a row of increases is good. We're also pleased to see it's based on performance. We don't think that this ought to be a blank check for higher education. They ought to earn it. Would we like to see more? Of course. We would. And we want to see that, Mark, because we want to make college more affordable for kids. That's what we care a lot about. But we do think it's moving in the right direction.
But what is the vibe among your members? Is it more frustration or is it more gratification?
No, I think it's gratification. I mean, we feel like we have made a difference and we're gratified that the governor and legislature are starting to really get behind this push that higher education needs to be one of the state's priorities.
You've got two other targeted priorities for 2013 at Business Leaders for Michigan. Another one also involves education, early childhood.
It does. And we feel that, you know, what we need to do is get kids off to a great start so that they can eventually get to college and get a great career. And we know that kids that get exposed to early childhood education when they're four-year-olds do better in the K-12 system and do better for the rest of their lives. The governor's proposal to expand early childhood education for more kids, we think, is a move in the right direction.
There is such a consensus that is gathered around the early childhood cause. Is that that's a data-driven thing, I assume?
It is. We're looking at national research studies that show that kids that Participate in early childhood, do better in terms of their learning. They get in trouble less in terms of the criminal justice system. They also earn more money. And so we think it's important to give these kids, you know, particularly those from lower and income classes, the ability to be able to get the education they need to succeed in school.
And your third big priority for the year, transportation infrastructure.
Yeah, we think that's extremely important. You know, we are connected to this global economy, whether we like it or not. That's where our goods and products and services are going to be sold. And if we don't have the infrastructure to connect us to that economy, we can't participate. And so we think that it's important to invest in the infrastructure. We see the condition of our roads and bridges aren't what we'd like them to be. And we think it's time that we invest more money in them.
Are your members generally behind the governor's billion-dollar-plus proposal to beef up the state's roads and infrastructure?
We, Mark, you know, we are, but I would say that we're also very open-minded about the exact way in which this funding is going to take place. We realize that it has to work itself through the political process, and so we've tried to communicate both to the governor and the legislature that virtually any reasonable proposal they come up with, we would support.
You make a point. We're talking with Doug Rothwell of Business Leaders for Michigan here on Current State. You make a point of including both university presidents and company chief executives in your group. What's the dynamic between those groups in the aftermath of the business tax cuts and these cuts to education?
Well, I think it's there's been an understanding that we needed to get our house in order here in Michigan, and that's what really we think the governor and legislature have done a very good job of these first 2 years. I mean, if you recall, Mark, a few years back, there was drama every time we were trying to get the budget passed. We had the Michigan business tax, and then we had the single business tax, and it changed back and forth, and all of that led to a lot of uncertainty for everybody, not just business, but also even those in higher education, that they didn't know what their revenues were going to be. And all that drama has really been taken out of the system by good fiscal management these past 2 years. So I think even our university presidents recognize that that was something important to do. But now, as we talked about earlier, we think the time has come to start investing more in those things that are going to most drive the economy, and higher education is one of those.
The impact of right to work in Michigan will probably be argued passionately until meaningful data comes in many months from now, and it will probably be argued long after that as well. What do you and your members think right to work's impact will be in Michigan?
Well, we think that it's probably going to have a positive impact in the long term for the state. We do know that right to work is a factor for some businesses in terms of where they decide to locate. We do know that Michigan was kind of redlined, if you will, as a state by not being a right-to-work state by some of those businesses, particularly manufacturers. Small and medium-sized manufacturers tend to be more sensitive to locating in a right-to-work state than those that are not. We never took a position on right-to-work because, you know, frankly, we had a lot of other issues on our agenda, and we at the time felt kind of like the governor did, which is that we were concerned about it getting us sidetracked off all those other issues that we think were also very important. But now that it's the law of the state, you know, we would hope that it is going to be another way in which you can bring more business into Michigan.
You've got 80-some members?
Yes.
Is that right?
That's right.
And how many of those members have unionized workforces, roughly?
You know,
any idea?
I really don't, Mark. My guess would be is that probably a third to a half of them at least do, because, you know, many of our member companies are large manufacturers, which, you know, many of which have a unionized, organized workforce. And again, I think that what, you know, we would say is that there have been tremendous progress made in terms of the relationship between labor and management in Michigan that gets often overlooked. You look at what happened with the car companies as an example of that, and, you know, they would not be able to be where they are today without some of the great progress that those relationships made. But, you know, the fact is that, you know, we also have to look forward, and hopefully right to work will be a positive for Michigan.
Are you watching the legal actions against the law?
Yeah, we're following that, and we're, you know, also the political fallout that could come from it. I'd say that the best thing for Michigan right now is to look forward. It's the law of the state, and let's try to hope it brings in more jobs.
Doug Rothwell is the president CEO of Business Leaders for Michigan. It's been great having you in here, Doug. Thank you.
You're welcome, Mark.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we do a segment on Michigan's energy future that we lead the show with. Also, a phenomenon called the baby moon phenomenon. It's kind of a variation on the honeymoon, okay? That's, a newlywed couple goes on a honeymoon before they start their lives together. Well, before they have a baby, a lot of couples are increasingly taking baby moons, little getaways, knowing that their lives are going to change dramatically when they get back or shortly thereafter. That's all coming up tomorrow on Current State. Joe Lindstroth is our Current State producer. Peter Worf is our executive producer. Aaron Young is our engineer. I'm Mark Bayshore. Join us tomorrow. It's Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Douglas J. with two Lansing area salon locations, the Okemos Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for Valentine's Day. DouglasJ.com.